Good afternoon and welcome to all of you to the 2008 Spring Institute on Live Theology. I am so delighted that you have come and joined us for these 2 days of conversation and exchanges on Live Theology and the language and practices of peace. My name is Charles Marsh, and it's just been wonderful reconnecting with old friends, people who took part in Project and Live Theology events in 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003, and then people I'm meeting for the first time. Our theme this year comes from a dear friend of ours at the Project who passed away last year. Some of you were, as I, privileged to know Victoria Gray Adams. Victoria Gray Adams was an extraordinary prophet of justice and practitioner of peace. She left a successful business position in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, in 1963 to become a field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and worked alongside Ms. Fannie Lou Hamer and Reverend Ed King and Aaron Henry and others organizing the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. After her years in the movement of the 60s ended, she became a spiritual advisor and Wesleyan director at Virginia State University in Petersburg. I met Victoria Gray Adams 10 summers ago when I was heading south from Baltimore without really a clue what I was doing, with a micro cassette recorder and a credit card and a full tank of gas, and just started talking to people about faith and civil rights. And she was kind enough to put up with my meandering questions and gave me hours of her time at a coffee shop in Petersburg, and later, when we moved here, became a friend of the Project. Spoke in numerous gatherings here. Some of you might recall the astonishing presentation that Victoria Gray Adams and Bob Moses gave in the spring of 2003 here on the civil rights movement as theological drama. Some of us were transformed by that experience, and I encourage you to visit the Project website and take a listen to those tapes, both Bob Moses and Victoria Gray Adams. She had a remarkable ability to take a group of students and not only describe the civil rights movement as this fascinating, you know, historical period, but to make it come alive and to really conjure the energies and the emotions and the convictions of the movement, and to make them feel like they were ours to carry on. And in her last visit to Charlottesville, in a gathering at our house to a group of students, some of you may have been there. I can't remember. At the end of her presentation, one student said, "Well, what is the unfinished business of the civil rights movement?" And without any hesitation, Ms. Adams said, "It's learning to speak the language of peace." And I've heard a lot of long and interesting and compelling and complicated responses to that question, what is the unfinished business of the civil rights movement? And I've probably written some long and complicated responses to that question. But she named the challenge. And so shortly after that gathering, Ms. Adams died of brain cancer in her home in Petersburg. But we celebrate this day and over the next several days this extraordinary voice of justice and freedom, a prophet, a saint, a dear friend. So thank you, and thank you for being here. I will now turn over the stage to Jenny McBride, who has just done unbelievable things in making all of this happen, and an organizing genius, someone who really does combine those wonderful passions of theological writing and research and translating those into concrete reality. So you can say a few words about SILT and the days ahead, and look forward to getting back up here in about 15 or 20 minutes. I'm a bit nervous. I've never actually started a SILT before with my own lecture. So I've usually just been a fly on the wall enjoying all these inspirations. So in any case, I'll see you in a minute.
Hello. After months of communicating and planning, it's really wonderful to see you all gathered here for the next two or three days. We have in this room pastors and practitioners and activists and community workers and organizers and scholars and students and writers, and all of us here are some combination of these things. So we think that it's actually this fact that makes this time so fruitful and unique. Whether your job title is scholar or student or pastor or community worker, the Project on Lived Theology assumes that we need help from one another to know how to build peaceful and just communities and a peaceful and a just world. So we encourage you to come as you are into these conversations over the next 2 to 3 days to bring insights from your work and experiences with you. So this is the third almost annual Spring Institute in Lived Theology. In 2005, we had theologian Jürgen Moltmann and Pastor Mark Gornick talk about the spirit of social hope. And in 2006, we had theologian Timothy Gorringe and Pastor Heidi Newmark lead us in conversations about the spaces of redemption and reconciliation, a theology of the built environment. Both these times were very rich, some of you all can attest to. And the approach that we had for those times was an informal, collaborative approach. And this year, we talked about how we can make it even more collaborative. So we expanded those two speakers to 16 speakers. So we hope that we can kind of see this time as a workshop. We hope that we'll all be energized and encouraged, that our imaginations will be stimulated and expanded about what is possible, and that relationships and collegiality will be built and strengthened over this time.
I hope my opening comments are helpful. Many of these themes will be familiar to you, but hopefully in their totality, important questions and considerations will be raised that we can turn to and that can enrich our conversation in the days ahead. And this is Sam Bush, who just appeared in the back of the room, who's also joining us. Come on up here and sit in these chairs, guys. Yeah, I should have asked whether our distinguished mayor could help out with some of these parking tickets, but maybe that's abusing my privilege. When I was a graduate student here in the 1980s, the intellectual scene in the humanities clustered around exciting conversations in literary theory and philosophical hermeneutics. Postmodernism ruled in the discourse of the human sciences, and one of my involvements was the Theory Group, a monthly seminar that discussed the new literature. Not only graduate students in English, but also in religious studies, where I was hanging out, German and French lit, history and philosophy, met in the Colonnade Club, where lunches sometimes dragged late into the afternoon. This is how I first came to know Richard Rorty, the former university professor who the New York Times called one of the world's most influential contemporary thinkers when he died last June, and to become a lifelong admirer of his work. Professor Rorty was right in the middle of all the intellectual energy, of course, and seemed to be having the time of his life. But he was not at all your usual pomo with the black jeans and the gravity-defying haircut. For one thing, Professor Rorty preferred khakis, a wrinkled dress shirt, and the navy blazer he threw on the chair whenever he entered the classroom. More importantly, he wanted us to know that reading books and discussing theory must do more than make us interesting. Books and theories should make us compassionate citizens. Standing in the tradition of such critical patriots as John Dewey and Herbert Crowley, Rorty advanced a pragmatic standard of truth and told us that progress and knowledge and society should be about attending to and solving the specific problems that obstruct ever more novel, ever richer forms of human happiness. Rorty's arguments and his cautionary words were well aimed at a generation of graduate students living in Ronald Reagan's America, concerned more about its psychosexual adventures than the staggering numbers of homeless and unemployed pouring into our nation's streets. Rorty criticized French philosophers like Michel Foucault for a dryness produced by a lack of identification with any social context, any communication, a criticism Rorty brilliantly recast in his 1997 Massey Lectures at Harvard, published as the superb volume Achieving Our Country, Leftist Thought in 20th Century America, a book that I've used in many of my own classes. Rorty spared no punch in his attack on the political evasions of the contemporary academy, which he accused of siding too often with the etherealized politics of academic radicalism and forgetting the reformist, get-your-hands-dirty disciplines of the old left he so dearly loved. Mr. Rorty also weighed in on the debates about postmodernism and religion currently in vogue. One trendy movement at the time, some of you may remember, in theological circles, was that of deconstructionist theology. If you were a deconstructionist theologian, you believed that the disappearance of God and the disappearance of the self, as advanced in the discourse of modern atheism and postmodern philosophy, did not signal the end of religion, but in fact created exhilarating new possibilities for religious self-creation. For my money, one memorable afternoon in Jefferson Hall, a few doors down, marked the end of the deconstructionist theology movement, as I knew it, and at least for my own mind, further exposed the exhaustion of a certain theological habit of trying to make the idea of God palatable to modern culture. It was not quite the momentous Black Day in August 1914, which the theologian Karl Barth described in his book, The Humanity of God, when 93 German professors and writers proclaimed their support of the war policy of Kaiser Wilhelm II, the day Barth realized he could no longer follow the direction of 19th century Protestant theology. But it was close. The deconstructionist theologian, who liked to call himself an A/theologian, began with a quote from a then-fashionable book called The Parasite, which included a scene of rats chewing on a Persian rug in the Paris sewers. The atheologian proceeded to talk about the demonized other of the West and to accuse Rorty of promoting a dialogue that concluded in a monologue spoken, written, to colonize the other. Rorty was called a cultural imperialist, a privileged white male wielding his machete of irony against the otherness of the other, hacking away at the difference of the different at an other that is forever other, a difference that is always different. The book called The Parasite included chapters as Rat's Meals, Satyr's Meals, Rat's Dinner, More Rat's Meals, Lunar Meals, Meals of the Lord in Paradise, The Cows Come Out of the River, Cows Eat Cows, and it was praised for its capacity to unsettle the logocentrism of the Western tradition. I refer you to a forlorn 1989 University Press of America volume entitled On the Other, Dialogue and/or Dialectics, for more on the rodents and the cows eating the cows. As far as Rorty's own response to these charges, that fine afternoon in the spring of 1989, in the Jeff Hall Symposium, let me share with you two gems. Quote, first, Pascal earned himself a footnote in the theology books by distinguishing between the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and the God of the philosophers. Since Pascal's time, the former God has remained about the same, but the latter God has gotten weirder and weirder. Second, as the old-fashioned kind of atheist, the kind without the slash, I keep wishing that we just didn't have any theologians. The world would be a better place if theologians all went away. As much as I love this performance, I think deconstructionist theology was too easy a target. Ridiculing the flaws of an intellectual franchise doomed from the start by its overwrought management was intellectual overkill, pure and simple. Rorty knew this, of course. He knew that his thrashing of the postmodern slashers, as he called them, got out of hand. And I don't mean in the sense in which he confided in me the next day in his office that he was feeling a little ashamed of himself. I reassured him he had no reason to second guess his performance. His was the most brilliant piece of stand-up comedy I have seen to this day. I mean, I wish I could have helped Mr. Rorty understand that the kind of theologian he had publicly and deservedly mocked had long been exposed for fraud by theologians of a very different stripe. And I don't mean only his maternal grandfather, Walter Rauschenbusch. Over the past several years, as our nation has been at war and the global and world community have grown ever more troubled, my thoughts have turned time and again to sermons preached by Dr. King in the final years of his civil rights ministry. You know these sermons, a Christmas sermon on peace, I See the Promised Land, and the searing, heartbroken, A Time to Break Silence, that sermon delivered at Riverside Church in New York 1 year to the day of Dr. King's assassination in Memphis. A grim date, of course, whose 40th anniversary we have commemorated this past spring. These are sermons in which one hears an unmistakably heightened prophetic urgency and, one might say, an eschatological intensity. In those late years of 1967 and 1968, with chaos and disillusionment all around, and with so many of his early supporters gone, Dr. King railed against the prophesying of smooth patriotism and against those who had exchanged devotion to the teachings of Jesus with the Southern way of life and with American ambition. With the nation unhinged by violence at home and abroad, King's final sermons read in places as a lament for our country. "It is midnight in our world today," he said. "We are experiencing a darkness so deep we can hardly see which way to turn. Everywhere, paralyzing fears harrow people by day and haunt them by night. Our world is sick with war. I fear our nation's soul has been poisoned." The words are telling. 10 years earlier, the same Baptist preacher, while serving a church in Montgomery, Alabama, had summoned together a group of social gospel reformers calling themselves the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Their motto, their mission was, as you know, redeeming the soul of America. But now, if there is any redemption to be found in the darkening soulscape of the nation as the Vietnam War casts its shadows over those glorious, though short-lived, experiments in social reform, it would not be found in military might or political power or in the acquisition of material possessions. "Our only hope today," King said, "lies in our ability to recapture the revolutionary spirit and to rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter but oh so beautiful struggle for a new world. This is the calling of the children of the living God. We stand," Dr. King said, "in the fierce urgency of now." Why had my dear Professor Rorty not for a second imagined that asking the theologians to all go away might have something to say to Dr. King? In any case, I think that people of faith And not only the secular interpreters of the movement, but liberals and evangelicals also share a lot of the blame as well. Having traded freely on the popular secularization of King and his legacy, that King might be a brilliant orator, a poet of democracy, a shrewd organizer, a man who could speak truth to power, a predictably, maybe, Protestant liberal social reformer, but not a man of deliberate devotion whose thinking and acting, one might say, were Christocratic in shape and scope. Never mind his own self-identification, you know, I am many things to many people, but in the inner recesses of my mind, I'm a Baptist preacher, the son of a Baptist preacher, the grandson of a Baptist preacher, the great-grandson of a Baptist preacher. Dr. King was also, not to be forgotten, a brilliant young philosophical theologian, a freshman at Morehouse at the age of 15, first in his class at Crozer Theological Seminary, a PhD graduate from Boston University. So I ask you, as we begin our 2 days together, in consideration of the theme, Theology and the Language of Peace, to take some time with me now at the outset to rethink our public construction of this theologian, of this pastor, of this Christian martyr, who said, segregation is the blatant denial of the unity we have in Christ Jesus. Who said, the end of life is not to achieve pleasure and avoid pain. The end of life is to do the will of God, come what may. Who bore witness to the Prince of Peace, exemplified costly discipleship, and proclaimed that, quote, the great event on Calvary signifies more than a meaningless drama that took place on the stage of history. It is the telescope through which we look out into the long vista of eternity and see the love of God breaking into time. Well, you know the story. I mean, you know the story of the Montgomery bus boycott. But I want to revisit it again briefly here, if only because I think that this story offers important lessons for us, our conversation and our exchanges over the next several days. And indeed, I think that this extraordinary volume of the King papers that Claiborne Carson edited, of the papers from 1955, December, to the end of 1956, are some of the most important and surprising and rich theological documents that we have been given for this work of thinking about theology and peacemaking. When Dr. King, actually wasn't Dr. King at the time, he was A.B.D. King, Albert Dissertation King, came to Montgomery in the spring of 1954, civil rights activism was not foremost in his mind. King came to Montgomery because it offered a nice salary, a comfortable parsonage, and a highly educated congregation. Dexter Avenue Baptist Church had no interest in racial crusading either. Church members had long prided themselves on their access to white elites and their own relative social privilege. They certainly shared a common hope of a future without Jim Crow, but they were not going to ignite the fires of dissent. One of the exceptions here, of course, was the Women's Political Council, which throughout the early 1950s had issued numerous formal complaints to officials of the Montgomery City Lines regarding disrespectful bus drivers and unfair seating arrangements. In her own memoir, it's a terrific book, The Montgomery Bus Boycott and the Women Who Started It, Women's Political Council founder Joanne Robinson described the evolution of the activist infrastructure in Montgomery in terms which largely excluded King and his fellow clergymen. In fact, Dr. King, at the time now, in the fall of December of 1955, actually had to be talked into accepting the leadership of the MIA, the Montgomery Improvement Association, by Ralph Abernathy, when the organization was formed the day after Rosa Parks refused to move from her seat in the front of the bus. And King accepted only after being reassured, or perhaps tricked into thinking, that the boycott would be over in 24 hours. This is what sort of Abernathy led him to believe. Dr. King, in any case, was busy with other things, revamping the church structure, writing a plan for a new staff, and becoming a great preacher in the Baptist tradition. In King's first list of demands as president of the MIA, he made clear that the protest was not about challenging segregation. Did you get that? Not about challenging segregation. The NAACP refused to endorse King's initial demands. King was no fan of nonviolence either. One of my favorite stories comes from a field report filed by Glenn Smiley of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, who visited Montgomery in early January 1956, who was astonished to find in the parsonage on South Jackson Street an arsenal of weapons. Dr. King said, "When I was in graduate school, I thought the only way we could solve our problem was an armed revolt." By the end of the second month of the boycott, King had fallen into despair about his leadership and the direction of the movement. The protest was in disarray, and its fragile unity was on the verge of breaking down. On a gloomy day in January 1956, feeling that he was a failure, demoralized and exhausted, he offered his resignation as a president of the MIA. It was not accepted, but his doubts about his own abilities as a pastor and organizer remained real and unabated. The next week, King returned one night to his parsonage after a long day of organizing and planning session. He had also just endured his first arrest and wanted nothing but to climb into bed and surrender to a good night's rest. But then the phone rang, and on the other end of the line rushed a torrent of obscene words and then a death threat, the N-word. "We've taken all we want from you. Before next week, you'll be sorry you ever came to Montgomery." King hung up the phone without comment, as had become his custom. But hopes of much-needed rest were gone. Threatening phone calls had become a daily routine throughout the weeks of the protests. And in recent days, though, the number of calls had started to take a toll, increasing to 30 or 40 each day and becoming much more menacing. You know the story, but I want to tell this story again to you briefly. Because alone now in this midnight kitchen, amidst the silences of the Alabama night, King grasped for the first time the utter and complete seriousness of his situation, and with it the inescapable fact that his family could be snatched away from him at any moment, or more likely he from them. And King began to pray aloud. In his memoir, Stride Toward Freedom, King said, "I heard the voice of Jesus saying, still to fight on. Jesus promised never to leave me, never to leave me alone. No, never alone. No, never alone. He promised never to leave me, never to leave me alone." And King says that as the voice of Jesus washed over that despicable threat of the caller, that he reached a spiritual shore beyond despair and anxiety. "I experienced the presence of God as I had never experienced the divine before," he said. "My fears began to go, and I felt ready to face anything." A week later, and a few days after his home was bombed by Klan terrorists, Dr. King preached a sermon at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, a sermon that's included in the most recent volume of papers edited by Claiborne Carson, a sermon called "It's Hard to Be a Christian." We don't have the sermon, but the manuscript, though thanks to the wonderful work of the editorial team at the King Papers Project at Stanford, we have the notes of that message. The sermon was based on chapter 16, verse 24 of the Gospel of Matthew. "If any person will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." And we have King's notes that read, "Most of us in the American congregations have substituted a cushion for a cross. We have substituted the soothing lemonade of escape for the bitter cup of reality. But Jesus never left people with such illusions." he made it crystal clear that his gospel was hard because it demands a dangerous and costly altruism. Authentic faith is hard because it demands that the I be immersed in the deep waters of the thou, that we put our whole being in service to the beloved community. I think it is worth emphasizing that after his spiritual and theological transformations in this Montgomery experience, King's engagement of the social order became more rather than less confrontational. He became more rather than less willing to contest the material and legal conditions of injustice. He authorized shortly thereafter attorney Fred Gray to challenge segregation laws. And he made clear that he has supported immediate integration of the buses. Segregation is evil, and I cannot, as a minister, condone evil. King told reporters that his decision against calling segregation into question had been a mistake, and he needed to be reversed, and it needed to be reversed. And King also gave up the gun. He said, I realized I couldn't serve God and the gun. And his lifelong pilgrimage in nonviolence began in earnest. I also wish to note here that a profound and intriguing conflict with the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr came to the surface in these weeks and months. King has often been called a Niebuhrian for his sober recognition of human sinfulness and the need to confront unjust institutions and structures with tough and effective organizing. King's Holt Street Address, this is the first address that he preached first week of December 1955, had commended the tools of coercion and sounded the notes of political realism. Yet the Niebuhrian resonances fade from King's speeches as the bus boycott unfolds, and for good and very interesting reasons. At the moment, the black church in Montgomery began to put its faith to the test and contest the unjust social order, Reinhold Niebuhr was admonishing patience. And as Carol Paulsgrove wrote in her brilliant book, Divided Minds, Intellectuals, and the Civil Rights Movement, Niebuhr struck a gradualist note that sounded no different than William Faulkner. When the Supreme Court handed down the Brown versus Board of Education decision May 17, 1954, making illegal segregation in public schools, Niebuhr had praised the court for its boldness and concern for the political realities of the decision. We had also expressed hope that the nation would give the white Southerner some time to accept the decision and proceed in a rational manner to implement its requirements. The slow erosion of racial prejudice was underway, he said. The utter naivete of that remark was not lost on King. And indeed, Niebuhr might have shared that sentiment with the founders of the White Citizens Council for a good laugh. The Citizens Council, as you know, had in 2 short years since Brown versus Board grown to an influential organization with branches in almost every southern town. And there was no sign at all that any gradual change was going to take place as a result of their largesse. Surely one might expect something a little more forthright, a little more moral, from the foremost exponent in the United States of the Protestant crisis theology. This is Irving Howe writing his magazine Dissent. King had not missed these troubling equivocations on Niebuhr's response to the Montgomery bus boycott. It's also interesting to note that as early as his graduate student presentation to the Dialectical Society at Boston University, even as he praised Niebuhr, King had worried about Niebuhr's Christology. Niebuhr's Jesus is pure abstraction, King had said in 1953, not the Jesus of history, who walked in Jerusalem. Of course, there was no way at the time that King could understand the implications of his Boston presentation for the events ahead. For what he discovered in 1956, of course, is that an abstract Jesus could not offer meaningful instruction to the African-American church on its social mission in the Jim Crow South. King would risk his life on the proposition that the imminence of agape can be concretely conceived in human nature and history. This is Dr. King's quote, and also another quote, that the availability of the divine agape is an essential affirmation of the Christian religion. The moral precepts that shape the Christian life begin with the affirmation of the historical cosmic reality of the incarnation. This was the theological realism that King would embrace. I am convinced, King wrote in a letter to Lillian Smith, the novelist and social progressive from Georgia, in the spring of 1956, I am convinced that God lives. And the movement came alive because of that conviction. King's experience in Montgomery, though not just the single experience of the kitchen, as much as I'd like as an old Baptist boy to focus on that, but the whole protest year that followed pressed upon him a sober counting of the cost of his ministerial calling. Marcus Garvey Wood, pastor of the Providence Baptist Church in Baltimore, observing his friend and former classmate's transformations, said it best in a letter. You have thrown Crozer aside, and you have found the real God, and you can now tell the world that he is a God who moves in mysterious ways. In the final weeks of this 382-day protest that launched the 20th century America's greatest social movement, King told a jubilant crowd at the Holt Street Baptist Church, which had just received word of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in favor of the Montgomery Improvement Association, that while we will need to protest and to boycott, the end is not the protest. The end is not the boycott. The end, Dr. King said, is redemption. The end is reconciliation. The end is the creation of beloved community. When Dr. King boarded the bus the next week, sitting by Glenn Smiley, that same white Presbyterian minister who had come with FOR to file the report in January, Dr. King told reporters, now is the time to move from protest to reconciliation. Sometimes it feels like we as a nation and in the churches remain frozen at that very moment. Over the course of Dr. King's lifetime, especially in the last 2 years of his life, the deep wounds wrought by the sinfulness of humanity, his own term, sinfulness of man, in American society intensified the idea of the beloved community theologically. And in time, the idea came to express with an even greater sense of crisis the eschatological inbreaking of God in history. In fact, according to Duke theologian Richard Lisher in his fine book, The Preacher King, after 1966, King removed the term beloved community from his speeches and sermons and used instead only the kingdom of God, the biblical term for the eschatological reign of God breaking now, can you believe it, into ordinary towns and cities in the deep South in judgment, crisis, and upheaval. Lisher writes, as King's social idealism was succeeded by more realistic appraises of human evil, references to the beloved community gradually disappeared from his sermons, and in their place we see only the kingdom of God. I would add that King's use of the term beloved community always differed significantly in tone and intention than its Protestant liberal antecedents. Nonetheless, it is certainly true that in these final years, we discover an astonishing rhetorical and theological shift in his speeches and sermons. The growing sense that the structures of creation are fundamentally, ontologically broken, and that only God can save us from ourselves. Life is a continual story of shattered dreams, King told his Ebenezer congregation in March of 1968. The world is all messed up. The nation is sick. Trouble is in the land. Confusion is everywhere. The righteousness of God would not transmogrify the human condition. The human condition would not be transformed from the inside out through some inexorable and innate force. Indeed, until 1965, 1966, social progress in America had by and large confirmed the confident alliance between hope and achievement, so that the direction in which the achievement pointed seemed to confirm the hopes. John Howard Yoder, in a fascinating essay on King, talks about this confluence of optimisms between the expectations of the federal government and the hopes of the liberating God. But in 1966, that confluence is ruptured. What happens to religious hopes when worldly achievement becomes distant and deferred? The eschatological intensifies. In Dr. King's case, I think the eschatological gives way at times to apocalyptic. The righteousness of God divides and sunders. It comes as crisis of history and culture. In the last year of his life, King turned his attention directly to the economic sources of racism, organizing the Poor People's Campaign, which he hoped would dramatize the sobering fact that the right to vote and to eat in any establishment failed to affect material conditions, the material conditions of discrimination. Among the demands of the Poor People's Campaign were full unemployment, a guaranteed annual income, and construction funds for low-cost housing. King had planned to lead a procession of mule carts with thousands of people in tow from Mississippi to Washington, where the participants would construct a shanty town near federal buildings. King thought it would be especially powerful to bring some actual shotgun shacks from the Mississippi Delta on flatbed trucks and reassemble them on the D.C. site. The proposed date for the beginning of the Poor People's Journey was April 22, 1968. On April 3rd, as we know, Dr. King took some time away from the Poor People's Campaign to visit Memphis to lend his support to the sanitation worker strike at the invitation of his lifelong friend and colleague, James Lawson. The city's mayor there was refusing to recognize the union, and on February 1st of that year, two African-American workers in this horrific story were crushed to death by outmoded equipment as they took refuge inside a sanitation truck during a rainstorm. On April 3rd, Dr. King delivered his final sermon at the Mason Temple in Memphis, the headquarters of the Church of God in Christ, the largest African-American Pentecostal denomination in the United States. The early spring day happened to be extremely hot, and by the time the service began in the evening, the skies had opened in a violent thunderstorm. When King took the pulpit, the lightning was still flashing outside with claps of thunder. King, many of you know, appeared both agitated and exhausted that evening, and a few times the ceiling fans would make a banging sound and visibly startle him as he spoke. The fans were then shut off, making the sanctuary almost insufferably hot, but complete in its concentration on King's words. He spoke directly to the church that night, and he urged the preachers of America to be like Amos and say, "Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream." Somehow, the preacher must say with Jesus, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he hath anointed me to deal with the problems of the poor." Dr. King told the ministers that it's okay to talk about the long white robes over yonder. It's okay to talk about the kingdom of God that will come in splendor and glory at the end of days. It's quite all right to talk about streets flowing with milk and honey. Still, God has commanded us to be concerned about the slums down here and his people who can't eat 3 square meals a day. It's all right to talk about the New Jerusalem, but one day God's preacher must talk about New York, the New Atlanta, the New Philly, the New Los Angeles, and the New Memphis. Dr. King's thoughts moved restlessly, but seamlessly, if that's possible, from talk of economic power and the power of collective action to global liberation movements, to meditations on Jesus and the Jericho Road, and to words that registered a haunting sense of his own death. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop and I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will, and he's allowed me to go up to the mountaintop, and I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. And I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. King saw the promised land, and the promised land that night was the blinding light of the coming God. After King finished, he fell backwards, exhausted, into the arms of his lifelong friend, Ralph Abernathy, and he was murdered early the next morning. By the way, the same year, across the Atlantic Ocean, in the Swiss city of Basel, Karl Barth died peacefully in his home on the early morning of December 10th. Barth's biographer tells us that he lay in bed as though asleep with his hands gently folded from his evening prayers. And in his notebook he had written, "In the light of grace, all that is now dark will become very clear." Last conversation was with his dear friend Edward Ternason, who had called to talk about the gloomy world situation. Barth and King had met a few years earlier in Princeton and had a brief, though memorable, exchange. Ternason, in any case, remembers Barth saying in that final conversation, "Keep your chin up. Never mind, he will reign." Well, Richard Rorty's classes here in the late 1980s, his intellectual courage and his writings, particularly the books Contingency, Irony, and Solidarity, Achieving Our Country, Philosophy, and Social Hope, helped me, and I think help all of us, understand that the intellectual life must seek to promote human flourishing. It must seek to prevent cruelty, and it must build solidarity among diverse communities. One of my favorite lines Rorty ever wrote was, "Disengagement from practice produces theoretical hallucinations." And for his life and legacy and his many acts of kindness to this graduate student in religious studies, I will be forever grateful. But it is finally Dr. King and the theological agitators and reformers and dreamers, practitioners, who teach us that disciplined and focused and sustained practice in pursuit of justice requires spiritual nourishment, religious hope, and theological conviction. By the way, let's not forget about Memphis, okay? I did want to add one important point, that King's death is not the end of that story. On the day after his funeral, workers resumed daily meetings at the United Rubber Workers Union Hall. and resumed marches from Claiborne Temple through downtown shopping district. James Lawson announced plans for another massive demonstration and for intensified boycotts of particular businesses, and he demanded increased black employment and civilian review over police, who he said had invaded homes without warrant, brutalized people, and even stole their money during curfew. And by the end of May 1968, the city of Memphis recognized the union, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and signed a four-point agreement with sanitation workers, which included a non-discrimination clause and an item that read, "The city shall make promotions hereafter on the basis of seniority and competency," a clause which effectively eliminated white supremacy in hiring and promotion policies in the Memphis Sanitation Department. I commend you to this wonderful new book by, I think it's Michael Honey, called Down Jericho Road, about the Memphis story. Well, I'm running out of time, but let me just continue my own opening reflections here by concluding with a few words that I hope bring some of these comments to unity. The philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche once said that Christians would need to sing more beautiful songs before he would believe in their Redeemer. Well, I think Christians have beautiful songs to sing. And if you listen closely, you will hear that the men and women who work day in and day out in inauspicious places to bring healing to the broken and blistered world are people who are carried and strengthened and nourished by deep spiritual waters, who show that vivid and synoptic realism, if you will, about the nature of social existence is honest and clearly drawn against horizons of grace. Think about the great progressive social movements in American history and the movements for human flourishing, the campaigns to end slavery, the great struggles of the labor movement for women's suffrage, the social gospel, the work of mercy and justice in the historic peace churches, the contemporary flourishing of people of faith dedicated to reconciliation and community building, and of course the civil rights movement. Visit a soup kitchen, a hospitality house, a tutorial program for low-income children, an AIDS clinic, a hunger relief agency, a Habitat for Humanity site, a student group sitting in an administrative building in support of a living wage for workers. And you will find there people who are moved to act in response to the world's concrete needs because they have seen a light shining in the darkness, who believe that transcendence empowers rather than diminishes the love of life, that hope and miracle and mystery animate the protest against cruelty, focus moral energies, and heighten discernment of those places in the world that cry out for our healing and wholeness. The philosopher Søren Kierkegaard once wrote of faith as the most complex artwork, and yet the most exquisite and the most demanding. Well, Dr. King spoke of the spiritual movement in Montgomery. Fannie Lou Hamer of the New Kingdom in Mississippi. Clarence Jordan of the God Movement in Southeast Georgia. John Perkins of the Quiet Revolution of building hope in distressed and excluded communities. Victoria Gray Adams of the Enfleshened Church of Peacemakers and Reconcilers. These are all ways of talking, are they not, about the body of Christ set free from political and cultural bondage, to be the space in the world where the world sees the love it longs for and the hope it desperately needs. The civil rights movement that took place in the 1950s and 1960s not only changed unjust laws, but brought about, can we not say, a spiritual awakening, though perhaps a spiritual awakening whose lessons have not been fully understood. And this story, unleashed from its own bondage to secular historiography, teaches us even today important lessons about what my dear friends John and Vera Mae Perkins like to call a holistic gospel. Dr. King's dream was not his dream, not the dream of the 1960s, but the dream of God, a gift of the Spirit, the beloved community of Christ. In his book, and this is the final point, in his wonderful book, Violence and Death, Thomas Merton urged Christians to realize that their calling, our calling, does not make us superior to other people. We are not asked to be masters of meaning, to colonize the truth and make it our own possession. Christians must rather learn to participate in God's created order, and thus to link arms with all those who care about the human condition and the created order. Our job as Christians, Merton says, is to struggle along with everybody else and collaborate with them in the difficult, frustrating task of seeking a solution to common problems, which are entirely new and strange to us all. This illuminates, I think, both our hope and our discipline. To speak with the humility that is appropriate to our limited vision, and by speaking, to take part in shared human struggle. One must not only preach a sermon with his voice, Dr. King said, he must preach it with his life. Abiding with Christ, we learn to relinquish our claims on God and to see that shared struggle is the place where proper humility is forever nourished, and that shared struggle is the place where we must learn to speak the language of peace. So thank you very much.